Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we have the one and only George Weigel with us today, the Distinguished Senior Fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He is a Catholic theologian and one of America's leading public intellectuals. We always enjoy his weekly commentaries, and millions around the world have read his New York Times bestseller, Witness to Hope, his biography of Pope St. John Paul II, and its sequel, The End and the Beginning. George, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Great to be with you, Ashley, and to meet you, Betsy. Thank you for having me.
Well, so it's been a while since we've had you on the show, but we were anxious to catch up, especially as we celebrate Pope St. John Paul II's upcoming feast day, the month of Mary, in this beautiful month of May. But before we get into the life and legacy of John Paul II, we wanted to touch on a column that you recently wrote that you addressed to Cardinal Hollerich on a completely different matter. So I thought I would, if you'll permit me, I'd love to read a couple of clips that stood out to me. You were addressing his comments on the ordination of women. You specifically said, "The question of who can be admitted to holy orders has never been understood as a secondary matter of ecclesiastical discipline. It has been understood to engage the very nature of the ordained ministry, which is a constitutive part of the structure of the church, and the church is Christ's creation, not our own. Has the church misunderstood Christ for 2,000 years, or did Christ get it wrong in structuring the church and its ordained ministry as they have been structured for two millennia?" So for our listeners who are not quite keyed in, can you tell us what he said and expound a little bit on what you meant in your response?
Sure. Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich is a Jesuit who spent actually most of his life in Japan. He's the Archbishop of Luxembourg, and he is that in no small part because there is a concordat between the Vatican and Luxembourg, according to which a native Luxembourger has to be the Archbishop of Luxembourg. Let's say candidates are not thick on the ground in Luxembourg. Hollerich is brought back to Luxembourg as the Archbishop. He's then made a cardinal by Pope Francis and was one of the key figures in the synods of 2023 and 2024. Recently, he did an interview with a German Catholic website in which he said that he didn't understand how the church could survive if half of the human race were being hurt by not being called to holy orders. So I just thought this was worth raising a few questions. You know, what's the hurt involved here? Who's being hurt? But even more importantly, what does this say about his understanding of Christ's intention for the church and the Holy Spirit's guidance of the church? And I asked, you know, have we been getting it wrong for 2,000 years? I mean, what happened to Christ's promise to preserve the church in the truth through the working of the Holy Spirit? This was in my weekly column, and I called it an open letter to Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich. And I sent him a copy. I said, I don't believe in hitting people behind their back, so here's a copy. I have not heard from His Eminence since then. Perhaps he's disinclined to answer me. The deeper question here, Ashley and Betsy, is the question of can the church, should the church, could the church surrender to what is increasingly becoming a unisex culture in which maleness and femaleness are understood simply as accidents of biological evolution rather than as disclosive of great truths about the human condition. And as I said in the column, the biblical view of all this is that human beings are made male and female, equal in dignity, complementary, fruitful in that complementarity, but not reducible to each other or to some neutral kind of status. And this is, of course, the question of what some call the culture wars today. Is there such a thing as human nature? Are there givens in the human condition? Or is everything in the human condition plastic, malleable, fungible, changeable by acts of will? You know, I can get up in the morning and call myself Georgina, and you are required to respect that. Is that the truth of the human condition? Those are the deeper questions involved in this. It seemed to me that the cardinal was simply surrendering to European wokery, which he was doing, I might say, on a regular basis at the synods of 2023 and 2024. But there are deeper questions here, and I wanted to raise those.
This is a pet topic of mine because, as someone who goes on the media a lot, I get asked the question all the time, don't you feel disenfranchised from the church because
Right.
you cannot be a priest, be in the conclave, things like that? And it's very, I don't know, dissonant from my lived experience as a Catholic woman. It's not something I've ever heard any Catholic woman bring up as a frustration, but I thought it was interesting in your letter that you called it a certain kind of clericalism. Can you explain a little bit about what you meant by that?
What I meant by that is that so much of this conversation for well over 40 years now has been about power. Who gets to tell who what to do, which is in fact a very unchristian notion of power. Power in the church is the ability to summon up from everyone the moral and spiritual grandeur for which they were baptized. Doesn't have to do primarily with who gets to tell who what to do. Secondly, there is a vast confusion about how that power is actually exercised in the church. I mean, anybody who grew up when I did in the mid to late 1950s, early 1960s, Catholicism knew that the real power in the parish, in many senses of the term power, was the principal, the sister, the nun, who was the principal of the school. She was the boss, and the priest pastor sort of did what he was told. Catholic women exercise enormous power in the church and the world today as educators, as healers, as mothers, as wives, as spiritual directors, as consecrated women, leading others to Christ. I mean, does anyone want to really tell the Sisters of Life that they're disempowered? I mean, what does that mean? What does that even mean? The other deeper theological question here is the one that my friend, the late great Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, used to raise when people would say to him, why can't women be ordained? And he would say, why can't women be ordained priests? And he would say, you tell me what a priest is, and I will give you an answer. And if the person gave the usual functional answer, the priest is somebody who does certain things, the cardinal would say, no, that's not what a priest fundamentally is. And the Catholic understanding of these things, which is drawn from the fifth chapter of St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, which speaks of Christ's spousal relationship to the church, the priest is an icon of the eternal priesthood of Jesus Christ. If that eternal priesthood is a spousal relationship, then the only available icon of that is a man. Women can do many things, be many things, great saints. The greatest saint in the history of the church is a woman, the Blessed Virgin Mary, but she was not an icon of the eternal priesthood of her son. And I mean, the very thought of it would have boggled her mind. So this question of iconography is really quite key here. But again, it's hard to get that across in a unisex culture where people can be anything they say they are. The other problem of clericalism here is, of course, that only the ordained can exercise not only power, but authority in the church. That's just not true. The authority that is exercised by an evangelically committed missionary disciple bringing other people to Christ is a greater authority than who's the vicar general of the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. I mean, if you don't understand that, then you've reduced the church to simply another NGO in which some people can tell other people what to do. And that is simply not a rich enough, thick enough understanding of what the church is.
George, we're watching this play out in real time in the Church of England. And as we tape today, actually, Pope Leo has met with Archbishop Sarah Mullaly. What are your thoughts on the Germans maybe being envious that the Church of England has done this, even though we know that that the Church of England is shrinking dramatically.
If they don't understand what a friend of mine said to me 30 years ago when I was in London, the Church of England is the church that most Englishmen know they don't go to on Sunday, then they're just missing the reality of the thing. I think, you know, the Pope received Sara Mullally because popes have received people claiming to be the Archbishop of Canterbury since John the 23rd. And in genuine interreligious dialogue and ecumenism, you know, one begins by taking the other as who they say they are, and you proceed from there. Now, we have a different understanding of apostolic succession than exists in the Church of England. The fact that this woman is now occupies that office in the Church of England has sharpened the issue in a dramatic way.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was preparing Witness to Hope, there's a fairly long section in there on the breakdown of the Anglican Roman Catholic dialogue in the mid-1980s. And it really was over the issue of who the church is authorized to call to holy orders. And there was a long exchange of letters between John Paul II and the then Archbishop of Canterbury, a man named Robert Runcie, in which John Paul and Cardinal Willebrands, Jan Willebrands, a Dutchman who was then the head of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, said to Runcie, you know, we know you're considering the ordination of women to the priesthood. Be aware that this is going to really throw a spanner into the works of our dialogue. And Runcie wrote back, I think I quote this letter at some length, and all of his arguments were essentially sociological. You know, women are doctors, women are lawyers, we've got a woman as prime minister, therefore. And John Paul II and Willebrands wrote back and said, where's the theology here? Where's the theology? Do you simply understand the priesthood in functional terms? Priests are people who can do certain ecclesiastical business. Or is the priesthood fundamentally iconographic, such that the priest, the ordained priest, in the exercise of that iconic role, to use that misused word in its proper sense, does certain things? And of course, there was no answer to that because the understanding of Robert Runcie was that the priesthood is essentially functional. And once that bridge was crossed in the C of E, that was really the end of a lot of great hopes. I mean, at the end of the Second Vatican Council, and despite Leo XIII having said that Anglican orders are not valid. I mean, he was pretty brutal. The phrase was absolutely null and utterly void. Despite that, there were still people who argued, no, there are reasons to think that for a variety of complex historical reasons involving old Catholics and other splinter groups, there might be a case for the validity of Anglican orders here. And that was brought up again in the wake of Vatican II. But this question kind of set things back a very, very long way. Because it was clear that there was a fundamentally different understanding of sacramentality and ultimately of human nature, of the biblical view of the human person. And what I don't quite get is why people of goodwill, I'm perfectly prepared to believe that Sara Mullally is a converted Christian disciple who really loves the Lord Jesus and all the rest of it, why she can't understand why the people who elected her to this position or proposed her for this position cannot understand that this is a concession to the worst of the modern anthropological crisis, the notion that everything in the human condition can be changed by acts of human will. Why they don't get that? Why the dots aren't connected? When one of the people who has made this argument most powerfully is a historian of the Reformation at Cambridge named Richard Rex, mm-hmm. is just beyond me. You know, there's a real sadness in this. And I think we should recognize that and certainly pray that this conversation gets back on track at some point, but innumerable and greater obstacles have been put in the way of that dialogue over the last 30 years.
Well, speaking of proper Christian anthropology and iconography, we're entering the month of May, which is devoted to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And you have written this about Carol Wojtyła. You said that young Carol Wojtyła began to understand that all true Christian devotion to Mary is Christocentric and Trinitarian. Mary's role in the history of salvation is not as some sort of independent feminine principle, but as the first witness to Christ, her son. Can you break that down for us, for those of us who are hoping to reflect a little bit deeper this month about the role of Mary in our salvation?
When young Karol Wojtyła moved to Kraków in 1938 from his hometown of Wadowice, he tells us in his vocational memoir, Gift and Mystery, dissatisfied with the conventional Marian piety that he had grown up in, because he thought it was a distraction from Christ, from concentrating his spiritual life on the Lord Jesus. And then during the Nazi occupation of Krakow, he was taken under the wing of a remarkable character named Jan Tarnowski, a layman who took over the youth ministry in his parish when most of the Silesian priests were hauled off to concentration camps where they died. And Tarnowski, among other things, gave Wojtyła the book by Saint Louis de Montfort, True Devotion to Mary. And in that book, Saint Louis de Montfort suggests that we take very seriously Mary's last recorded words in the New Testament, which are, of course, do whatever he tells you at the wedding feast of Cana. Now, preachers working with that text usually concentrate on the whatever, because as the gospel says, this was the first of Jesus' signs, and his disciples began to believe in him. The Montfortian exegesis of that text is that what's really crucial here is the pronoun. Do whatever he tells you. Mary's last recorded words in the New Testament are to point to her son, because that is her role in the economy of salvation. And by pointing to her son, who is both son of God as well as Son of Mary, she points us into the Trinity, because he is the incarnate Son of God. So Mary's role is, in fact, to point us to the two central mysteries of Christian faith, the Incarnation and the Trinity. And that's what Wojtyła, I think, took away from Montfort, and then developed that, deepened that insight over the next half century, such that he could tell the Roman Curia during his Christmas address to them in 1987, Mary is the paradigm of all discipleship. There are many forms of discipleship in the church. There's a Petrine form of discipleship. There's a Pauline form of discipleship. There's a Johannine form of discipleship. But they all only make sense because of the Marian profile in the church, as he called it, because discipleship is what the church is for. She's the first of disciples, and everything else flows from that. So it's a very, very high Marian theology. There was nothing saccharine about it. There was nothing, Hallmark card gooey about it. I mean, this was pretty serious stuff. And I think that that was central to the spiritual life of John Paul II, when he, took as his papal motto, Totus tuus, I am entirely yours. He was committing himself to the first of disciples so that he could be the disciple he was baptized to be.
In your most recent book, To Sanctify the World, you're trying to make sense of the legacy of Vatican II. And I want to just get your take on you were 60 years. We have 40 years left, and you say it usually takes 100 years for the church to digest an ecumenical council. You've written extensively on how Benedict and JP2 sort of unlocked the council through their pontificates. What do you see so far with Pope Leo regarding, here we're going into the last 40 years of this Vatican II, and how is he going to shape the legacy of Vatican II?
Well, it's quite striking that Pope Leo has adopted the practice of several of his predecessors, and he's doing thematic general audiences in which, you take a certain topic, and in these little 15-minute talks on Wednesday at the general audience, you develop. This is how the theology of the body developed with John Paul II. Benedict did a whole thing on the fathers of the church. Pope Leo is now doing Vatican II. And what I've been able to read so far, he's doing it exactly right. He's beginning with the great constitutions on divine revelation and on the church. And so far, I have to say, I think his understanding of the council is quite parallel to what I wrote about in To Sanctify the World. Namely, the council was to reanimate the church for mission. The purpose of the council is evangelization, John the 23rd said a month before Vatican II convened. And these Leonine general audience addresses seem to me very much in along that line of analysis. I think since we're talking about Vatican II and John Paul II as well, let's remember, no Vatican II, no John Paul II. I mean, the notion of a pope from Poland who first made a big impression on the world church at the Second Vatican Council. I mean, nobody was thinking of this in 1962. I mean, this would never have happened. And for all the confusions and consternations and air turbulence of the post-Vatican II years, there have been an enormous number of blessings as well. The vibrancy of the church in sub-Saharan Africa would not have happened without the Second Vatican Council. A lot of what we see in the living parts of the church in the developed world has been made possible by Catholics taking seriously the teaching of the council, as amplified by John Paul II and Benedict XVI, that we're all missionaries and everywhere is mission territory. So, as for the 100-year rule, I will not be around for the centenary of Vatican II. But that seems to be really the minimum. I mean, the First Council of Nicaea in 325, by writing that creed that we recite every Sunday, thought it had settled the problem of Arianism. Jesus is really not the Son of God. He's some sort of half-created reality. Well, go to your local Unitarian church today, and Arianism is alive and well. You know? So it settled it for main. Council of Nicaea settled Arianism for mainstream, mainline Christianity. But, you know, the confusions of doctrine and theology continue long past councils. The Council of Trent defended the sacramental system of the church. There are Reformation churches which still have not gotten that message 500 years later. So everybody needs to relax a little bit and concentrate on what's at hand, which is the evangelization of families, workplaces, neighborhoods, culture, politics. God knows, needs some evangelization these days. And perhaps worry a little bit less about what the Pope said yesterday morning. I mean, this obsession with petrocentrism, as I called it in a column a year ago, is really distorting people's view of the church. And I think Pope Leo understands that.
Well, we just have time for one more question, and it's one that's really been burning on my mind. I was very privileged to attend the Tertio Millennio Seminar, which you helped to found many years ago, the purpose of which was to bring together young Catholics from America with those that had lived under communism or Eastern European nations. And one of the things that was we were so well educated about on that seminar was not just John Paul II's faith witness, but his great courage in standing up to the evils of communism. It seems like there's among young people a rising affection again for these evil regimes, communism, socialism. And yet, at the same time, there's this wave of converts coming into the church. Do you see any of that seeping in among young Catholics?
Well, the big problem I see seeping in is anti-Semitism.
Amen.
I mean, there is a really nasty anti-Semitic edge on some, particularly young Catholic men today who are listening to lunatics like Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes and whatnot, and the unwillingness of people like Tucker Carlson, and if I may say, the Vice President of the United States, to disentangle themselves from all of that is a real problem. Now, as far as the seminar in Krakow is concerned, we've had a war going on next door for the last three seminars, and we'll have one going on next door this year, and that tends to concentrate people's minds. What I have noticed, and particularly last year, is something that really would have been inconceivable when you did the seminar, Ashley, and that is the vulnerability of some of our students from Central and Eastern Europe to Russian propaganda, which is just ubiquitous. I mean, they flood the zone in social media, online, various propaganda instruments that they infiltrate into different countries. This is a real problem. And when you layer that onto the obvious problem, Poland is hosting over 1 million Ukrainian refugees right now. And they've been in the main wonderful about this, but there are obvious social tensions, even though those refugee Ukrainians now pay more in taxes than they're costing the Polish government in services. So they're a net economic plus. But there are tensions. So this is stuff that we just couldn't have imagined 10 or 15 years ago. But it's what we have to deal with. We've added a session on combating anti-Semitism and why that's essential to the program this year. We'll have four Ukrainian students again this year who they're the best witness to what's going on there. The basic problem that you mentioned, this kind of fascination with socialism or crazy people like the current mayor of New York, is a lack of understanding of history. I mean, if you don't know that this has never worked and it's been tried many times and it doesn't work, then you're going to be vulnerable to these siren songs of, the warmth of collectivism. Well, they weren't too warm in the gulag, I'll tell you that. I have several friends who are gulag survivors, and they were freezing to death in Siberia. They weren't experiencing the warmth of collectivism in Perm Camp 36. They were looking for blankets. So these are just, we try to, as a faculty, identify what needs to be addressed each particular year. And we have added the necessity of combating anti-Semitism to the program this year.
Well, George, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule with your prolific writings to chat with us today. For those of you looking to read more of his work, please visit georgeweigel.com. George, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Great to be with you both. Thank you. Let's pray for each other.
Thank you. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. I'm Ashley McGuire of the Catholic Association, and today we are covering a crucial case set to be heard by the United States Supreme Court on whether or not Colorado can exclude Catholic families from universal preschool programs. And here to flesh out the particulars is Nick Reeves, Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks, Ashley. I'm happy to be here.
So, Nick, you are the attorney representing these families and the preschools in this case. Can you give us the backstory?
Absolutely. This case began in 2023 when Colorado told families they would start offering what's the equivalent of about $6,000 a year for families to attend the preschool of their choice. It could be a public preschool, a private preschool, even a religious preschool. But soon after Colorado created this program, Catholic families who were interested in participating were told that they would not be eligible for this benefit simply because they chose a Catholic preschool for their children. And soon after, we at the Beckett Fund started working with some of these Catholic families to try to challenge this religious exclusion. And the case has now made its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So, flesh out a little bit more about the religious exclusion. Were these families told that any faith-based school is disqualified, or is it certain schools, and if so, why?
Yeah, so Colorado created this universal preschool funding program, and they said anyone would be able to participate. This is to help all children in Colorado. What happened in reality, though, is that Colorado said for these Catholic schools to participate, you have to give up your religious beliefs and your religious exercise. And specifically, what they said is if you want to allow families to attend this school and receive this benefit, you have to be willing to compromise on what you teach in the school. You have to be willing to accommodate hypothetical transgender preschoolers, whether that's in a bathroom policy or a pronoun policy or a dress code policy. And these Catholic schools, they take seriously their mission to support parents in the religious education of their children. And what that means is they can't teach something in the school or affirm something that's contrary to their religious beliefs. And so that really is the heart of this case. Colorado has excluded these religious schools because of their religious beliefs and their religious exercise, and that has left about 1,500 Catholic families out in the cold and denied them this crucial benefit simply because these Catholic schools are unwilling to give up their religious beliefs.
So when I first saw the news stories about this case, my first question was, haven't we already covered this with the numerous more Blaine Amendment related cases? But specifically, I was thinking of Trinity Lutheran, which was also a preschool. It was a case at the Supreme Court argued by the Becket Fund that had to do with religious preschools being excluded from universal programs. Can you refresh us a little bit on that case and tell us why that precedent doesn't cover this case?
Absolutely. So, in a line of three cases, starting with Trinity Lutheran, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court has said over and over again that if the government creates this generally available benefit, maybe that's tuition assistance, or in Trinity Lutheran, it was funding for schools to improve their playgrounds, whatever this benefit might be, the government cannot exclude religious groups, religious schools, religious individuals from that funding because of their religious exercise. That's what the court has said three times in the past 10 years. Our view is that those cases should resolve this case. So Colorado and the court below suggested the cases were different simply because the exclusion here is not explicitly based on religion. The law doesn't use the word religion to keep out religious groups, even though the effect is the same. And what we're saying is that difference doesn't really matter. If you're being excluded because of your religious exercise, it doesn't matter whether the law says you're out because of your religious exercise or you're out because you're unwilling to compromise on your religious beliefs in some other way. So that's the difference between the cases.
And then what about, the other case that I thought should, apply here, maybe doesn't, but the adoption case, where adoption, again, the Supreme Court ruled in the favor of the rights of adoption agencies to function according to their beliefs. Can you remind our listeners about that part? There's been so many great religious liberty cases, and so many of them so wonderfully argued by the Becket Fund. But can you remind us about that case? Because it certainly does seem to be a pattern of whether it's schools or religious orders, charities. Doing all this great work and then being told actually they can only do it if they basically check their religious beliefs at the door.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that case was called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia from a few years ago. And the basic facts of that case were that Philadelphia was trying to exclude a Catholic foster agency from its foster care program and foster care contracts. And what the Supreme Court said there is that Philadelphia couldn't do this because it was applying a double standard. It was saying, we will not allow you, Catholic organization, to participate, even though we'd be willing to consider it in other cases. We have this discretion and we could apply this standard differently to other organizations. Kind of like the Trinity Lutheran case, we actually think that precedent also directly applies here. What Colorado has done is basically the same thing. It's a double standard, it's a religious gerrymander. We have testimony from the trial in this case from the director of the Universal Preschool Program saying that they would be okay with preschools that exclusively served LGBTQ families or that exclusively served transgender students. But they're not okay with a program that asks any family, regardless of religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, simply to be open to and supportive of the Catholic Church's beliefs. And what Fulton and other cases like it have said is that the government can't apply a double standard. They can't be open to preschools that have certain restrictions for secular reasons, but then when it comes to religion, they, pull up the gate and say, you're not allowed in. So that's really the principle that we think Fulton stands for and that we think applies here as well.
Would you call this universal pre-K program a school choice bill? That's sort of my first question. And then my second question is, whether it is or not, it certainly does seem like school choice is having a moment. Got great programs cropping up all over the country. The first federal school choice bill ever passed last year. And a case like this makes me wonder if it's headed towards a collision course with religious liberty, or if that's a way, a tactic that some will use to cut down school choice. What are your thoughts on that, and how does it fit in with this particular case?
Yeah, so here, what Colorado has said they've created is called a mixed delivery system, which is, I think, relatively similar to school choice in that it's not just public preschools, it's a variety of preschools. So they've said public, private, home-based, co-ops, all these preschools are eligible. Families can send their children to any of these preschools. So in that way, it is somewhat like a school choice program where the government gives families money to attend the school of their choice. And I think the rationale for that is the same. Colorado has said we want families to be able to pick the best preschool for them. The problem here is that Colorado has said you can pick the best choice unless it's the Catholic school. And in that case, we're going to draw the line there. We're going to let in almost 2,000 other preschools with all kinds of different, unique programs and requirements. And we'd even let in a preschool that explicitly served or only served transgender students, but we're not going to let in that Catholic preschool. And I think the lesson to take away is that if you want to have a school choice program, what you can't do is open it up to everybody, but then have a religious gerrymander that keeps out a handful of religious schools.
So, in reading articles about this case, I kept seeing references to a very old Supreme Court precedent known as Smith. Can you talk about that for our listeners who are not attorneys and how that plays in and why we're constantly hearing these religious liberty cases being referred back to that precedent?
Absolutely. So, Employment Division versus Smith was a case decided in 1990. Up until that time, what the Supreme Court had repeatedly said is that if the government substantially burdens your religion, they have to have a compelling reason, a really, really good reason for doing so. In the Smith decision that you mentioned, what the court said is, well, we actually don't think that's how the Free Exercise Clause works. Instead, all the government has to do is treat everybody equally. So they changed the law from a liberty interest. You have this right to engage in religious exercise unless the government has a good reason to stop you, to an equality interest, where the court was saying, we think religion just has to be treated as well as any other secular thing. So as long as the government treats everybody the same, that's kind of the whole ball game under Smith. What's interesting, I think, about Smith is that even from the beginning, not only was there kind of some question and pushback, but the court has repeatedly said that certain types of religious exercise and protections aren't actually covered by Smith. So even though the court appeared to be laying down a general rule, in the 3 decades or so we've had since Smith, the court has carved out parental rights and the right of churches to hire and fire ministers, and a combination of free speech and free exercise rights from the Smith rule. So it's a bit of an odd precedent. It's unclear when it applies. The Supreme Court doesn't actually apply it all that often, but it's still in the background in all these cases.
So, what is the fate of the families that you represent? First of all, how many families are there? How many preschools are affected? And you said this has been going on since 2023, so that's almost 3 years. I'm a mom of five kids, four of whom are in Catholic schools. I'm thinking that's a lot of lost potential money to be applying towards these schools. And I know that so many parents who do send their kids to Catholic schools really do it at great sacrifice. I know that the Catholic Church heavily subsidizes these schools. So can you tell us a little bit of the kind of color commentary about these families and what they're doing to sort of make it work while they wait, while their cases sort of in legal limbo?
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been really difficult for families. Just in the time since 2023, when this program started, actually two Catholic preschools have closed, and enrollment across the Archdiocese of Denver's preschools is down about 20%. And I think that really speaks to how difficult it is for families to be able to continue choosing a Catholic education when all the other options are now free. There are about 30, 32 or so Catholic preschools in the Archdiocese serving somewhere in the range of 1,500 families. We have a number. We've been working with a number of families. The named plaintiffs in this case, Dan and Lisa Sheely, they have seven children, two of them who recently completed preschool, and they lost out on $6,000 per year for each of those children. They have another child who's 2 years old now, who they're hoping will be able to benefit from this program. But Dan is a police officer, and Lisa works as an administrative assistant. They're really sacrificing. They're sacrificing a lot so that their kids can get a Catholic education, and that's something that's really important to them. And talking to them and talking to other families, I think people feel betrayed that Colorado has said, we're going to create this program, but if you want a Catholic education, you're basically the only one who has to pay for it out of pocket in addition to paying your taxes, while all the families down the street who have preschoolers are getting this thousands of dollars of government benefit every year. So yes, it's not, it's a legal issue, but it also has very real consequences for these families and really for the fate of Catholic education as well. I mean, when the government is putting its thumb on the scale and saying, we're going to subsidize all these other preschools, but if you choose Catholic education, you're going to have to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket. I mean, that's basically the equivalent of putting a tax on Catholic education. And that's really devastating.
It's a great way to put it, a tax on Catholic education. And I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I'm a taxpayer there. And like I said, I have five kids. And I think I'm imagining for many of these parents, they feel like public schools are not even an option necessarily because of the case that emanated out of my home district, which thankfully the Supreme Court ruled in the favor of the religious rights of parents. But because of the way certain ideologies are pushed on kids, and up until the Supreme Court made this decision in my, about having to do with Montgomery County Public Schools, there was attempts to force children to have lessons as young as in preschool about things that violated the very basic religious beliefs of those children's families. And so I know that a lot of people feel as if Catholic schools, a lot of Catholics feel as if Catholic schools are the only place where their rights as parents are respected. So we're almost out of time, but just tell us sort of what are some of the next steps? The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. What's next?
Yeah, so we are busy working behind the scenes on the briefing in this case. We're expecting oral argument before the Supreme Court, probably in the fall, most likely in October. And we could expect a decision from the court as soon as maybe April or May of next year. We're optimistic that we'll get a good result in this case. We think the fact that the court granted this case suggests that they also saw some problems with the court's decision below. And yeah, we're very hopeful at this point.
Great. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining today to break this down for us. Where can our listeners find out more about the Beckett Fund and follow updates on this case?
Absolutely. Again, the case is called St. Mary's versus Roy. You can find a case page with all the legal briefs and other materials on Beckett's website, www.beckettlaw.org. And you can also find the case materials on the Supreme Court's website as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by TCA Chaplain Monsignor Roger Landry, who is also the U.S. Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies. Monsignor, we're about ready to enter the month of May, and we have a big feast day on May 1st. Can we talk about St. Joseph, please?
So since 1955, the church has marked on May 1st the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker. It was originally instituted in our calendar by Pope Pius XII, who was concerned about all the communist May Day celebrations taking place and the whole communist approach to work, which was geared toward making workers instruments in a much bigger machine rather than looking at the especially important spiritual dimension of the work that we live. And so he created this day to celebrate St. Joseph the Worker. We know on March 19th, we always celebrate the solemnity of St. Joseph in the entirety of his life. But this is a day in which we can turn to St. Joseph, whom St. John Paul II called the very epitome of the gospel of work, and learn not only about work, but learn how to work better. St. Joseph teaches us a few things. First, he teaches us how our work is supposed to be centered on the Lord. We're not supposed to be working independent of him, but working alongside of him, sometimes working with him and working for him, just like he used to in his Nazareth carpentry shop. That all our work is supposed to be in tandem with the Lord Jesus, like all other aspects of our life are supposed to be through, with, and in him. So that's the first thing we see. The second thing, St. John Paul II really pondered the meaning of work specifically under the image of St. Joseph, the guardian of the Redeemer. And he said, work has two principal impacts. The first is that we make something outside of ourselves. Like, for example, we make a pulpit if you're decorating a church or fix a car. But as we're doing that type of activity, we're likewise making ourselves. That there's the transitive aspect of work, the objective aspect in which we make something outside of ourselves. But as we're working, we're actually building ourselves up in virtue if we're working well or if we're lazy or sloppy in our work, like building ourselves very poorly, like a house built on sand, as Jesus' image in the gospel would be. And so St. Joseph teaches us how to really build ourselves up no matter what work we're doing. And this leads to the larger question about the whole sanctification of our work, that we're called to offer our work like Abel offered that pleasing sacrifice to the Father. It might be world-changing work in which we're discovering a cure for cancer, or it might be the type of simple work in which we're helping somebody to have a nice breakfast or keeping our streets clean or you name it. Like all honest work is able to be given over to God and is pleasing to him. That's the sanctification of the work. Then as we're doing that work well, that's the way we're working out our own salvation. That we are becoming more as we do that type of work well, as we're serving people, as we remember who are receiving this type of thing, as we do it as a thing of charity. And then third, the work that we do is an opportunity for us to encounter so many other people. And so it's an opportunity for apostolate. Just by the way we greet people, by the way that we show a little bit of the joy over the course of time, it might be the occasion for somebody to say, like, why are you always smiling? Or like when somebody looks saddened, is everything okay? Well, no, I just got the word that a friend of mine died, and just, I'm so sorry. Can I ask for your friend's name? I'll pray for your friend. And then all of a sudden they're saying, like, wow, what a kind gesture. Who is that mailman? Or who is that grocery store clerk? And so it's an opportunity for us likewise to be able to share our faith. It should never cease to surprise us that when Jesus called his first apostles, he called them as they were working, not when they had nothing to do. But Peter, Andrew, James, and John were fishing. Matthew was in the very act of collecting taxes. And that's where Jesus found them, and that's where he called them, because for us in his kingdom, he wants us to be all hard workers in his vineyard.
That's a great way to start May. You've been in Peoria this week, and can you give us a sneak peek of some of the preparations underway for the beatification of Venerable Fulton Sheen?
We had a Sheen Summit there in Peoria, led by Bishop Lou Tilke of the Diocese of Peoria, with a whole bunch of the people who are going to try to pull this beautiful, one of the greatest ceremonies in U.S. Catholic history off on September 24th. And so we were going through a bunch of the questions, meeting each other in person for the first time. Getting and giving some input on some of the bigger questions. For all our listeners, the tickets are probably going to become available on June 1st. We're still working with Ticketmaster to do the whole plan. The tickets will cost literally what they cost. The fee for Ticketmaster is $9. And so anybody who wants to go can go for $9. That's all just going to Ticketmaster. The Diocese of Peoria or the Pontifical Mission Societies or anybody else aren't making a penny off of it. It's obviously going to be free. There'll be 70,000 tickets made available. And we hope all of them to go. The beatification date is Thursday, September 24th. It's going to be great. We were planning the program before the beatification so that people can really get to know Sheen well from different angles, from those who are real experts on him, putting together a little bit of a musical program with some original songs for Sheen. There'll be some adoration because Fulton J. Sheen is the greatest preacher of a Eucharistic holy hour in the history of the church. And there'll be focus on his missionary work, on his work of conversion, on his work as a diocesan bishop, as a, you know, the various aspects of his life are all going to be there. So I came back super excited. I was able to visit where he was born, where he was baptized, where he made his first communion, where he was confirmed, where he was ordained a deacon and then a priest, where he celebrated his first mass, where he went to high school, where his parents are buried. And then on my way back, I was able to stop on the way to O'Hare Airport to visit the birthplace of Pope Leo XIV, who gave the green light for his beatification. And so, what a time in Illinois, and I can't wait to get back.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about this as the time grows closer. Thank you, Monsignor Landry.
God bless you, Betsy.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our fellows Ashley McGuire, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Ashley shared some little-known facts about Saint Carlo Acutis. Lee Sneed writes about her forthcoming book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com, and we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations.